Morning after pill.
I'm sorry, could you speak up, please?
I need the morning after pill.
Have you talked to your doctor about emergency contraception?
Well, I thought I didn't need a prescription.
You don't, but it's best if you see your physician.
Just give me the pill.
Have you considered adoption?
What the hell is wrong
with
you?
Okay, don't use that tone with me.
Please, I need it.
I'll let go of
it. I need it. I can't have his baby.
Then you shouldn't let him get into your pants.
No, please.
Get her out of here.
Don't do this. No, you don't understand. I was raped.
Mia, I'm Detective Benson. This is my partner, Detective Stabler.
Are you taking me to jail?
You cuffed a rape victim?
She created a disturbance. It's store policy.
Unhook her.
She assaulted me.
Unhook her.
Now.
Fine. Quickly. Mia, we're gonna get you to the hospital.
I'm pressing charges.
Don't press your luck.
City, sexually based offenses are considered especially heinous. These are their stories.
Hey guys, welcome to Munch My Benson. My name's Adam. I am joined on the line by Josh. How you doing out there, Josh?
You know, just kicking it.
Yeah, so as we mentioned in the last episode, we taped these really far in the future. And so while normally...
Well, far in the past.
Yeah, sorry. We air these in the future.
Yes. It's the future to us when you're listening to this.
Yes. So while we would normally talk about the things we've been watching, it's been hard to watch anything besides our entire society falling around in front of us. So that's all I've been really doing with my free time. How about yourself, Josh?
Pretty much the same. There's a certain point in every day where you're watching the police beat down rioters on Twitter, and then the news not really talking about that at all.
Yeah.
Just talking about looting because all we care about is property damage, I guess.
Yeah.
So there's a certain point in every day where you just sort of have frustration overload.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been able to watch some things. We started watching The Great, the show on Hulu with Elle Fanning and Nick Holt.
Okay.
Where she's Catherine the Great as she comes to Russia to be the Empress. And it's, you know, setting up the stage for her killing Peter the Third, which will happen at some point, I presume. But we're three or four episodes in. It's really fun. It's by the screenwriter who wrote The Favorite.
Okay. So it's good.
It's super fun in the new way that they're sort of doing historical dramas that still has a modern sensibility to it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's kind of like, I guess it's a little Game of Thronesy in that you're seeing these people being kind of conniving backroom backstabbers.
Right.
But that was one of the things I really liked about The Favorite, that aspect of it going on.
Oh, absolutely. And I liked how The Favorite sort of played on the reverse of what Lanthimos had been doing up to that point, where, you know, he was sort of doing characters in contemporary settings or the near future, near whatever future in The Lobster, but characters in contemporary settings where they're playing everything almost entirely devoid of emotion.
Yeah.
And then you go to the polar opposite for a period piece where that was sort of the standard and you're seeing the reverse of that.
Yeah. Now, funny you mentioned Catherine the Great, because my ancestors actually went to Russia because of Catherine the Great. So some of my ancestors were called so-called Volga Germans. So after she became the Empress of Russia, she decided to kind of invite German speakers to come to Russia and settle there to give her a sort of natural power base. And of course, these people had no real knowledge of what life was like on the steppes. It's a completely different environment than Central Europe. And so they lived way the fuck out past the Volga, you know, really in Asia. And they lived there for a long time. Eventually, of course, with various problems in the dawn of the 20th century, they were no longer welcome there. And so most of them had to flee. And many of them came to the United States. Most famous Volga German you've probably heard of is Reinhold Niebuhr, the famed philosopher of just war. Was what he did philosophy about. But yeah, that was my grandmother. She was one of them.
Are you also distantly related to Charlemagne?
You know, I haven't actually done that family tree, but it's possible.
Well, I mean, almost everybody with European ties is.
Yeah.
One of my biological uncles did 23andMe. I'm never going to do that
shit. Yeah, no, fuck that shit.
My DNA. But yeah, he did it, and yeah, I'm distantly related to Charlemagne.
Carolingian royalty. Well, speaking of period pieces, we have an episode today that features an actress famed for her work in period pieces.
Yes.
It is called Persona. It's from season 10. It is episode 8 in season 10. I need to go make my dog go outside.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh. We'll reset after this break. Ask your mother for 50 cents. Let's see an elephant I jumped up in. It jumps so high, it touched the sky. They'll get back till the 4th of July. Walking the dog. Yeah, you're so walking the dog.
So yeah, speaking of period pieces, we have an episode that features an actress known for her work in period pieces. It's called Persona. It's from season 10, episode 8, and it is kind of bonkers, honestly. It goes all over the place. You want to give us the recap, Josh? We can get right into it.
Yeah, this one is, I realized that I'd written almost a full page of recap, and we still aren't even to the Act 2 break. So here goes. A real dickhole lady pharmacist won't give Clea Duvall the morning after pill, clearly knowing nothing of her familial connection with Brother Justin and her role as the destroyer, or her relationship with a prominent politician's daughter. They get into a minor dust-up wherein she pleads that she can't have her rapist baby, calling Benson and Stabler to the scene. Clea, going by the name Mia Latimer here, details a violent attack in an alley. But when Benson and Stabler arrive at the scene of the crime, O'Halloran has already sent his CSU team away because an oil spill shows there couldn't have been a struggle here and that the victim is lying. Just as BNS start questioning Mia about her husband, figuring this is all a domestic violence case, her shithead husband shows up, talking about how cool he is with his legally registered Smith & Wessons. With Chekhov's gun being introduced, but the questioning being stymied, BNS check with the downstairs neighbors, both of whom are super recognizable, so you know there's gonna be a weird curveball in this one. Jonah Malcolm is a crime buff, but Linny wants to keep them out of the mix with the cops. He wants to help, but she's afraid of everything and hasn't left Manhattan in over 30 years. Their tenancy is in peril if they talk because he's wheelchair-bound and needs street access in New York, and Jonah's been in this apartment for 40 years. Benson assures her there are laws protecting tenants from retaliation and gets her to invite Mia downstairs, where she begrudgingly proffers that douchebag Brent controls her and tracks her ovulation cycle, complete with taking her temperature every day. He beat and raped her because she didn't feel well when he wanted to get his baby-making fuck on. He's perp-walked away, arraigned, and then cuts Mia off. Benson takes Mia to a DV safe house that is clearly not to Mia's liking, and 5 seconds later, she's recanted to her husband's defense attorney and is back at home on the Upper East Side. Benson tries to convince her to reconsider dropping the charges to no avail. Benson stands by at the door inside the shared laundry in the Malcolm apartment downstairs, waits for shit to go down, and then kicks the door in when the argument turns violent. But she's too late because a butcher knife has been plunged into her heart by her husband, who O'Halloran assures us is going away for life in the first scene back at the house. He also tells us that we might have a cold case that we can close too, as some lady plugged her husband 3 times back in 1974, but escaped just before trial. We quickly find out that her poet-dead husband became abusive when no one would buy his shitty, angry poetry, eventually telling her that he was going to kill her and then himself. She couldn't afford to leave, and her husband discovered her stash of money that she was squirreling away to run, so he raped her, thinking she'd gotten it from prostituting herself. She pumped him full of lead, and then the police came. Enter Elizabeth Donnelly. She's got unfinished fucking business with this old broad. Donnelly is a judge at this point, but she's taken a leave of absence to close this chapter in her life. Linny's escape happened on Donnelly's watch. Doing a Donnelly. This is all about egg on her face. According to Donnelly, this is also about the fact that Linny plays the victim well. Donnelly wants blood, but when she gets Linny on the stand, she discloses that she couldn't stomach having her rapist child, that she escaped so she could have an abortion. She gets off with probation for the escape, but not without her marriage shattering because she stole the chance of having children and grandchildren from her husband. And we get a weird, sad Dick Wolf at the end.
I describe it as a no-gun remassacre Dick Wolf. And that's because her husband, of course, is none other than star of stage and screen Mike Farrell, better known as Captain BJ Honeycutt from MASH. And when he finds out that his wife has been lying to him for nearly 40 years, he drops her about as fast as those GIs drop the hundreds of dead Koreans that they massacred. It is pretty brutal shit there at the end of that episode. If I were a more sentimental man, I might have shed a tear for that one.
Yeah, he is none too pleased with her.
No. And, you know, why can you blame him? I mean, she's not necessarily a bad guy, but at the same time, it is kind of bullshit to lie to your significant other for 40 years about what your name is.
You'd think that if this person loved you, they would probably be sympathetic to your plight if you had been brutally beaten and raped by your husband, who promised to do it again the next morning before you plugged in.
That's true. However, it's a tough call because I kind of get it from both angles. That's what kind of makes this a good episode, is that you sympathize with both of them in this situation.
Yeah.
Because sure, you understand why she murdered him, but at the same time, like, at some point you go, hey, hubby, listen, I've had a kind of complicated story, and when I met you, this is what happened. And the reason we didn't have a kid isn't because we couldn't, it's because I couldn't bear the thought, or, you know, I couldn't go, actually, it was because she couldn't go to the hospital because they would find out her identity if she did.
Which is like, what? They don't check your ID at the hospital, do they?
I mean, they might.
If she's on his insurance.
I mean, the thing is that she's wanted by the FBI. So, I mean, she's like on a most wanted list.
Well, they don't print you when you come in.
No, they definitely don't print you.
They don't fucking print you.
No.
The logic behind her decision to, like, go on the pill surreptitiously doesn't track at all.
Yeah, it's a little fucked up.
Anyway, whatever. That's neither here nor there. So, I started my analysis of the episode, or started my notes, and I totally thought Clea DuVall was in The Craft.
Yeah, I totally thought that Clea DuVall was fucking Jennifer Gardner when I first saw it. I was like, oh, Jennifer Gardner's in this one. And then, yeah, like, wait a second, that's not her. No.
I would have sworn she was in The Craft. She wasn't.
No.
However, Nathaniel Marston, her husband here, he played Trey in The Craft.
Weird.
More than that, he co-starred in The Craft with the director of this episode.
Weird.
Helen Shaver. Helen Shaver was in... She was, Fuck. She was one of the actress's mothers.
Nice.
Anyway.
But Clea DuVall's been in so much shit.
Oh, yeah. She's been in so much shit.
Yeah.
I referenced the fact that she was the destroyer.
Yeah.
She was Sophie in Carnival.
Yeah.
We're about to start rewatching Carnival.
Nice.
Coincidentally.
Carnival really should have gotten like 5 seasons.
It was supposed to be 3 books, basically.
Yeah.
And each book was two seasons. And so it was going to sort of reset with new cast the next season.
Oh.
I'm sure there were going to be some recurring people, but then HBO canceled.
Yeah. Well, basically at that point, Rome ruined all other HBO productions for a couple of years.
To be fair, Carnival cost $4 million an episode.
I can imagine. It was a huge production.
Yeah. It looked great. I mean, it looks fucking fantastic, but it's all on location, and it's period.
And it's hard for us to remember what a time was like before HBO kind of dominated prestige TV, because it definitely was making these prestige TV shows back then, but it wasn't, it just was kind of a different landscape, and those were not nearly as profitable.
Carnival was nominated for like a dozen Emmys.
Carnival was awesome.
Carnival was fucking great.
I mean, I enjoyed Rome a lot, but Rome was nearly bankrupted the network.
Yeah, everyone looked the same on Rome, and I couldn't tell anybody apart, so I stopped watching.
Okay, enough with Rome.
We're digressing.
Yeah.
Everyone knows who Clea DuVall is. We don't really need to do a big dive on her. Nathaniel Marston was also on One Life to Live for 6 years, pretty much leading right up to this appearance.
I mean, he's honestly great as a total just horrifying husband in this.
Yeah, totally. He died in 2015.
Damn.
He incurred serious injuries in an auto accident where his truck flipped and he wasn't wearing a seatbelt.
Shit.
His weirdest credit was Love Is All There Is, which was a modern retelling of Romeo and Juliet, where he was the Romeo and Angelina Jolie was the Juliet. This came out in 1996, the same year that the Leo Romeo and Juliet came out, but I watched like 5 minutes of it because it's all on YouTube if you want to watch it. I think I'm gonna watch the whole thing later.
I'm sorry.
This movie is fucking batshit. It's set like on Long Island or something, and Jolie is doing a bizarre Italian accent.
That sounds fun.
Like really fucking bad. So, it's to me, it's as bad as Meryl Streep's accent in Bridges of Madison County, where she's supposed to be Italian. And honest to God, I've had this conversation with other people, and they're like, wait, she wasn't Polish?
Was it as bad as Brenda Bledin's accent in Persona?
Jesus Christ. There's this weird moment where you're like, wait, is this character supposed to be from North Carolina?
I know. So Brenda Bledin, of course, plays the, as it turns out, the one we find out is the main character. It's funny, this episode kind of follows the same track that the last episode we did, with just this out of left field bonkers turn kind of midway through the episode, where it goes from being one thing to being something completely else. And in this case, the kind old lady who lives below Clea DuVall turns out to be the focus of the episode. And yeah, at times, I mean, she's been, according to her character, we don't know where exactly she came from. So I was believing maybe she came from the South originally, but she's been living in New York City, hasn't left Manhattan in 40 years.
It's baffling.
And at times she sounds, yeah, like she's from the South. And at other times she says things like she's from the North of England, you know, like,
did their fights ever get physical?
She had a broken arm last spring.
She said she tripped.
Hogwash, Lenny. The girl needs our help.
And who's gonna help us if he kicks us out? We'll never find another rent-controlled apartment that has wheelchair access. We'd have to leave the city.
Sweetheart.
No, Jonah. I won't do it. Brent's a monster. All smiles and good looks, but underneath there's only ice. I had a friend whose husband beat her. Said it was her fault. If she wasn't so stupid and worthless, he wouldn't have to hit her. And she believed him. But she escaped, and she found a man who would rather die than hurt her. I met you 3 weeks after I escaped from jail.
Escaped?
I had nowhere to go. I slept in churches, on the subway. I stole food, even a wallet. And one night it was pouring. And I went into a diner and spent my last dollar on a bowl of soup to get out of the rain.
There's some definite, oh, she's from Yorkshire or something. She's originally from Kent.
It's super weird. Her accent does not track here at all. She was nominated for 2 Academy Awards, one for Secrets and Lies in 96, one for Little Voice. She's the Bennett mother in the Joe Wright Pride and Prejudice, which my wife watches on a loop, basically.
Nice.
So I've seen Brenda Bletton a lot.
Nice.
It's weird seeing her play a non-Brit. And I don't know that it works. I posit that the accent is more distracting than anything else.
You know, one thing interesting about this role is oftentimes I think of movies being Oscar trash, particularly for this kind of established older woman actress who's like at a point in her career where she can decide what she wants to do and she's going to make an Oscar trash film. You know, I feel like every other Meryl Streep film is this. This episode strikes me as just dyed-in-the-wool Emmy trash. Brenda Bledin is out for an Emmy and will stomp on throats to get there.
Like, is she going for an EGOT?
Yeah, I know. Okay, should we start with the cold open? Because the cold open is so fucking problematic. It is so problematic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we get that shithead fucking pharmacist.
Clea DuVall goes to the pharmacist. Like, do your fucking job, lady. I think they have to, they have a code of ethics. You know, they are not allowed to do that.
Yeah.
I don't know the pharmacist code.
I think it's state by state, but I can't imagine that they're allowed to politicize this shit in New York.
Yeah.
New York isn't about to fucking outlaw the morning after pill or limiting access to preemptive, like birth control shit.
Yeah, exactly. Especially not in Manhattan. You know, it'd be one thing if you're like out in Queens somewhere in Copland and somebody says that shit, but not here. As I noted, I will totally burn down that pharmacy right now and sell all the drugs inside to whoever the Baltimore Police Department sold their shit to during the Freddie Gay riots. but again, sorry, this is way in the past when we're talking about this, so we're angry about different things.
We're a day like 9?
Yeah, something like
10 of insane protests The protest, obviously, completely justified, but there's some civil unrest.
Yeah.
That we're
disturbances. And now, we go to the hospital, and this is where we kind of find out that, well, we that's where the SVU cops come and interview Clea DuVall. And Frenchie from Greece is the nurse at the hospital, played by Dee Dee Cohn.
She's also Stacey Jones on Shining Time Station.
Yeah.
And she played Denise Stevens Downey on Benson.
Interesting. That's an interesting tie. And think of how much more fun would this show be if Benson were Olivia Benson.
Yeah.
And Olivia Benson.
Benson DuBois needs to be here. When they're having this conversation, Benson drops the line regarding the pharmacist. Maybe if they'd been raped, they'd be more compassionate. I know it's not meant this way, but it sort of sounds like Benson's hoping this pharmacist gets raped.
Yeah, Benson does a couple strange things in this episode, because there's another scene a little bit later, just a little bit later, where they're at the old lady's apartment down below Clea DuVall's apartment, and Clea DuVall's in there.
Let me help you. Listen to me, Mia. Listen to me. Please.
It's Mia. Okay, Mia.
Mia, I want you to look. Okay? Mia, look what he did to you.
Oh, my poor child.
Look at yourself.
Benson just straight up disrobes Clea DuVall. She just like reaches over and takes her shirt off.
Yeah, she forcibly disrobes her to make her really take in her bruises as though she doesn't feel them.
Yeah.
And then I guess it's okay because it's all women. Is that what the implication is here? The presumption that we're supposed to have is that it's okay because there's not like the male gaze.
Well, so it's interesting that you should note this because this episode really, as much as any that we've seen so far, definitely discusses feminism a lot. It's almost exclusively women acted episode. I mean, Mike Farrell's in it, obviously. Stabler's there, but really it's Benson is the cop and it's Clea DuVall.
I mean, Munch and Finn aren't in the episode at all.
No, Munch and Finn aren't there at all.
Wong isn't. It's basically just Benson, Stabler, and Cragen or Graylick are the only principal cast members who are in this.
Yeah, exactly. But primarily it's Donnelly, it's Brenda Blethyn, it's Clea DuVall, and it's Benson. And even like Stabler and Cragen are there, but briefly.
Yeah, Stabler takes the back seat. He's barely involved after a certain point.
This episode was both directed and written by women. It was directed by Helen Shaver and is written by Amanda Green. And so it's definitely, it was something I thought about immediately because it was like, man, they're really going hard on some of this stuff. And is it okay? Because some of the times I feel like the feminism, it's not that the feminism misses, it's that it almost fails the Bechdel test at times.
I was just thinking back, wait, is there a moment in this episode at all that passes the Bechdel test? I don't know that there is.
I don't know that there is either.
And I mean, to be fair, it is all women, and they're talking about how men are oppressing women, so it's ultimately still feminist, and it's not necessarily talking about, oh, I can't wait for my husband to get home for this, this, or this, but I do wonder if there's a moment in which they're not talking about how a male has affected their lives. Though that is ultimately the point of the episode.
Sure, but okay, so the one that I found really problematic, because it was shortly after Olivia disrobed Clea DuVall, she is talking, Brenda Blethyn, rather, is talking to Clea DuVall, and she says, you know, she's talking about herself, but we don't know that yet, but she says she had a friend back in the day who escaped from abuse and is now doing okay because she found a man who wouldn't dare ever harm her. And that really set my hackles up. I was like, what? Do what now? That's when I went to check who wrote it and directed it, and I found out it was women. And of course, particularly when Donnelly shows up, I mean, you've got Donnelly's career path coming at odds with this woman.
This case getting her kicked off of being the homicide ADA.
Exactly. And like screwing up her career, making her, you know, everybody say they pulled a Donnelly.
Doing a Donnelly.
Doing a Donnelly.
For years, whenever a rookie ADA pulled a stupid move, it was known as doing a Donnelly.
when she's prosecuting this woman who killed her abuser, of course, which wasn't a crime back then, because I guess a husband couldn't be charged with raping his wife back then, the show brings up.
I'm assuming we can make the leap that doing a Donnelly probably took on other permutations of inter-office slang.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's definitely not just an ADA screw on the pooch.
No, I think in the case of Munch My Benson, doing a Donnelly is Donnelly's showing up to screw over somebody that really is not that much of a perpetrator.
Yeah, is relatively sympathetic, but Donnelly's gonna fuck them up.
Yeah, Donnelly ruins the lives of sympathetic people. She destroyed those children's life in, well, that one kid's life in Juvenile from, what was that, episode 6?
Donnelly's essentially the destroyer from Carnival.
Yeah, no doubt. Donnelly, man.
She is taking Clea DuVall's role here.
Angela!
We've got to, I'm going to have to download a fucking audio clip of fucking Danza saying Angela.
No doubt, man.
Angela, sit down, please.
God, every time you see Donnelly, you're like, oh, great. Somebody we like is going to get it.
Yeah, without fail.
Now, another thing I really wanted to talk about, because we haven't brought this up. There's an elephant in the room. This is the first time on Munch My Benson that we've seen ADA Greylich. And I'm told you did a deep dive on Greylich, Josh. So you wanna kind of give us a rundown?
I did as deep a dive as you can do with Greylich. Greylich is played by Michaela McManus. She looks good.
She's very attractive.
Yeah, she's very attractive.
I don't like to besmirch anybody who is on screen for our enjoyment because they're obviously doing great and I appreciate them doing it. But most actors have a light in their eyes. There's this like recognition of their own humanity. They can sense their own consciousness.
And like an inkling of charisma too.
I don't get that from Kim Greylich.
There's a weird wrinkle with Greylich where Greylich is coming in to the unit as the ADA assigned to this unit. And she's coming in because fucking Novak just was suspended because she violated the Brady Rule. And so that's why Novak's out. And the presumption, and she does mention it in an episode, I guess, the presumption is that she has been brought in to rein things in because Novak was so, like, drunk on power that she did whatever the fuck she wanted and besmirched the office with her behavior. Now, Michaela McManus, as Greylich, appears in 13 episodes of SVU. She has the shortest run of any main cast member in SVU history and the third shortest run in the entire Law & Order universe of a main cast member.
Wow.
She replaces Novak, is replaced by Stephanie Marsh, who rides out the remainder of season 10 and most of season 11 as Cabot, before a string of random ADAs is introduced over the next couple seasons, including Diane Neal and Stephanie Marsh, who return for stretches.
It's like a Matryoshka doll of ADAs at this point. They just kind of open one up.
Seasons 12 and 13 are super fucking weird. There's the end of 11... right after Cabot leaves again, she goes to the Congo or some shit. She goes to the Congo, and then we get a run of Sharon Stone as the ADA. She's playing Joe something or other.
Yeah.
She was Stabler's ex-partner, so she has like a 4 or 5 episode run, and then season 12 is just musical chairs.
What was funny about this episode, though, is that Greylich shows up, and she shows up early, because in my mind, oh great, now it's going to be a court episode with the husband, and that's going to be the whole episode.
But the downstairs neighbors are Mike fucking Farrell and Brenda Blethyn. Yeah. And so the instant you see them, you're like, well, this episode, nah.
Yeah,
whatever this first case is about, that's not what this episode's about at
you
all.
You don't have Mike Farrell on the chair that he has. So he's in a wheelchair, Mike Farrell. And so part of the what's so sad is that they can't lose this apartment, which is it's a fucking spectacular apartment that they've got. It's just gorgeous. It's huge and it's gorgeous. And apparently it's rent controlled and it does have handicapped access.
And it's rent controlled from 40 fucking years ago.
Yeah.
So you know they're not paying dick for this.
They're
rent.
Paying like $150 a month for this place.
Oh, I bet it's like $40 a
month.
Yeah,
and it's fucking spectacular. But he's got this chair that, like, I mean, it looks like it's from the space age. It is, like, he's, like, floating around above the ground. You can't really whip out Mike Farrell and not have the episode somehow be about him.
The first time we meet him, he's super pumped that the cops are there.
Yeah.
Because he's a crime buff and has everything from Wilkie Collins novels, who I didn't know who he was, but he wrote the first modern English detective novel.
Huh.
to George Pelicanos, who, of course, is a novelist and a writer and producer on The Wire, Treme, and The Deuce.
Huh.
So, more weird commingling with The Wire.
So, the writers dropping in some of their faves.
Or maybe pals, you never know.
Yeah.
And then he jokes that because he's chairbound, he longs for a view to play out his Rear Window fantasy.
Yeah.
And that Lenny is his Grace Kelly.
Yeah.
She wants nothing to do with the police, though. Every time they try to, like, get them to cooperate for the first, I don't know, two or three scenes they're in, she is so reluctant that you're like, okay, something's fucked up here.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
something's rotten in Denmark.
Not only is she famous, but she's also like, she just says those kind of awkward things where you're like, oh, this episode's going to turn out being about her.
Oh, and your friend? You had a friend?
Yeah,
who
exactly.
had to get away from her abusive husband?
Mm-hmm,
okay.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
So we get some weird camera work, right? It's kind of the pivotal scene of the episode. And it's a very strange scene to me in general, because for some reason, well, so Liv goes over to Brenda Blethyn's apartment and they just kind of are hanging out in the laundry room while they hear the fatal confrontation between Clea DuVall and her husband.
Well, Brenda Blethyn isn't in that scene. That's a jump cut.
Yeah, no, so...
Okay.
So, but Liv goes over to there and they have this mm-hmm. conversation in the laundry room. And then it's a jump cut to the future. And Liv is just sitting there on the ground. And there's this very strange, like, handheld camera work where, and there's weird camera work throughout the whole episode. But in this one, the camera starts behind a pane of, like, frosted glass and kind of walks out to the side and then zooms in on Liv, who, again, is on the clock as a police detective, presumably with other cases, probably to file paperwork about, do other things. But she's just hanging out in this woman's laundry room and eventually is there to witness the fatal confrontation.
I feel like we should note that the weird camera work in this episode, it's not like it's bad, it's just weird within the construct of the visual palette that this show is creating.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not bad. It's just it stands out as being different.
Yeah, it stands out as being like more cinematic and less cinema verite.
SVU is so it has so many tropes of its own. I mean, this Law and Order does. It's kind of like it has its own tropes and sometimes they are so ingrained that you're just shocked to see something that's just slightly different.
The other weird camera moment, of course, is where...
Yeah, when they're jumping around, they're talking to the husband and to Brenda Blethyn at the station about their history, when they're just learning that it isn't what she said it was. And it's like jump cuts, it's like weird jump cuts, weird zooms, it's all over the place in that scene.
We do this high shot with a tilt down, and it comes in over the top of Brenda Blethyn's character. And it's almost like the camera is the sun and it's finally shining a light on this person who's essentially been in solitary confinement.
Yeah.
And so she's basically been like stuck in a cave. This is the moment where she gets to come out of the sun and everything is given the light of day. And so it's this weird moment where the camera comes over and it ends up like really close up on her.
Yeah.
Which is really odd for the show. I think the shot works and there's like psychological layers to it
mm-hmm.
that are interesting. It's weird in the context of what the show does.
Don't let the sun catch you lying. Oh, no, no. Lying at my front door. Hey, mama's done turned salty. And baby, you done made her so sore.
And there's that interview scene where they're interviewing Mike Farrell and Brenda Blethyn separately, and it's jumping back and forth between them. And it's well done because you get a lot of information in a short amount of time. But again, it is really different than what you expect from SVU. But I think it's successful in general, all the kind of weird things that they did.
Yeah, it works. And the issues with these scenes are mostly that there's an inconsistent accent.
Yeah, well, that's true. And there's a lot of Brenda Blethyn with an accent that fades in and out. It's to quote Mrs. Doubtfire. Her accent is as modeled as Rob Lowe's tan, you know? I could say what I was most disappointed about was that I was hoping we would somehow get some archival video footage of the dude's poetry. I was really hoping for that. That would have been a nice touch.
Yeah, instead we just got a really weird mugshot where the eyes are super fucked up and don't look like they could possibly have been that person's.
Yeah, it was a really fucked up photo of the guy.
I love the bit where she says no one wanted a bitter poet, and then he said that she was stifling consoling his muse.
Yeah.
Sounds like a true poet. What a douchebag.
Exactly. Yeah. Fuck. I said, fuck this shit. Yeah. I said he deserved to get shot for that line alone.
Yep. You're stifling my muse. Ugh.
So as we know, it's undoubtedly Brenda Bledin. We get to a point where she is talking about...
Well, I guess I mentioned it in the recap, but the first case, you know, the case that set all of this shit off.
Dropped like a stone.
So what happens is Liv kicks through the door. It takes her like four kicks. So I guess there's like a Stabler to Liv ratio in terms of Stabler can kick through a fucking steel door.
Yeah, Stabler kicks open steel doors. Yeah.
Yeah.
No problem.
With one kick, Benson, it's a wooden door. It doesn't seem like it'd be that reinforced because it's just really the barrier between laundry rooms.
Yeah.
Which is a shared space. Doesn't seem that insane to be able... I guess she's at a disadvantage because she's kicking from lower because she's on steps.
Mm. She can't put her full momentum into it.
Right. So that maybe that's part of it, but it does take a lot of kicks to get this door kicked open. And when she busts into the kitchen, he's saying that she tried to attack him, which is hilarious because you could hear everything through this door. And then she has a knife in the middle of her fucking chest.
Yeah. A kitchen knife jab straight through her sternum.
And she falls to the ground and blood starts pouring out of her.
A lot of blood.
Yeah, a lot of blood. A lot of blood. So then O'Halloran is just like, nah, this fucker's going away for life. And we drop it like it's hot. Like, this is, that's the end of any talk about this case, and it's all this weird cold case for the last 20, 25 minutes of this episode.
That brings up a good point, because I would say the cop that comes out the best in all of this, he's not actually a cop, is O'Halloran. O'Halloran is the one who breaks open the Brenda Bledin case, and he also is the one who basically figures out that Clea Duvall had been lying about her initial rape, that it wasn't
instantly a
stranger rape, and O'Halloran figures it out, and then...
He told CSU to fuck off, to kick rocks, like, nah, you guys don't need to be here, this is bullshit. Shit.
Yeah, and Elliot's like, are you busting my balls again, O'Halloran?
O'Halloran is a fucking consummate professional.
Yeah, he's good, man. It's another O'Halloran episode, honestly.
Yeah.
But I really want to get to what I find probably just about the most problematic SVU line of the episode, because at this point, Brenda Bledin is describing her abuse to Benson, and she makes a point of kind of, these lines sometimes flow together, and sometimes they stick out, and this one really stuck out to me. She said, he did every vile thing he could think of after this is midway through the abuse.
This is in the episode that set off her killing him, where he comes home, finds her stash of $50, which is like the equivalent of about $260 right now.
Oh, wow. Look at you figuring that out.
Yeah, I looked it up. Nice. I took it to the inflation meter on the US Gov site.
He accused her of being a whore and said he was going to treat her like one.
Yeah, that the only way she could have $50 was if she was selling herself on the street.
Yeah.
And so he then decided that he was going to give her everything that she deserved for being a whore, and it did every vile thing he could imagine to her.
Now, this is such an SVU moment, because one other show in trying to make a victim sympathetic forces you, the viewer, to think one thing and one thing only, and that is butt sex.
Oh, yeah, instantly. Especially within the time frame that this would have happened. This isn't happening in 1974.
Yeah.
The vile thing was probably ATM. You're welcome.
Yeah, definite vile shit, SVU. Thanks for making us think about that stuff.
Yeah, thanks, dicks.
Yeah. Now, again, it seems like we're going to get a Greylick episode, because Greylick shows up. So I have my note is like, great, now we get to hear Greylick read some lines again. And then she gets just totally cast aside. Donnelly walks through the door immediately and is like, nope, my case, get out of here. And we don't see Greylick for the rest of the episode.
Make dust, lady. I'm taking over. So Donnelly comes in. She's like, oh, I'm going to be turbo bitch. Oh, I love the scene where she gets reprimanded by the judge on this case. They're just doing the arraignment.
I assume the people request remand?
Unless you want to give her another 34 years on the lam.
Your Honor, we request home confinement with electronic monitoring. My client is her husband's sole caretaker. His disability requires round-the-clock assistance.
Hire a nurse. She won't shoot him in his sleep. Elizabeth, I expect better of you.
Well, and at this point, Donnelly is a judge, and that's a kind of a weird thing. I kind of don't buy that you can just like, I'm going to stop being a judge for a few weeks and become a prosecutor again.
I'm going to unjudge now, and I'm going to go back to the DA's office to finish this fucker off.
Yeah, it's a little suspect, but the reason they had to pull that is Donnelly fits the mold of the woman that had to come up as one of the leaders of the women's rights movement in the 70s, you know, like kind of at the same, the Hillary Clinton generation, you know, the first women leaders in the country, and had to make these kind of tough choices and play a dirty game in a men's dominated world. And they really make you think about this.
Yeah, had to like fight against the boys' club, essentially.
Exactly. But kind of live in that world and take the abuse and keep swinging. And so, yeah. I mean, there's a reason they had to use Donnelly for that, because she plays that part pretty well.
Graylick doesn't pass for somebody who could have been a lawyer in the 70s?
Well, not just that, but Graylick can't really read lines with very much emotion or feeling.
I feel like I've seen her in something else. I don't remember if she's okay in it.
McManus?
Yeah. I wonder if some of it is just because she's supposed to be playing a character that's cold to SVU.
I guess. I don't know.
I don't know how much of it is her and how much of it's what the part's supposed to be.
All I can say is, I've said this before and I'll say it again, she can Graylick my balls, Josh. That's all I'm saying. I mean, not literally. I'm not saying that in a hateful...
Not sexual way. Not in the sexually aggressive way at all.
No. Anyways, so the court scene is pretty... I mean, it's pretty powerful stuff, honestly. Again, it's undone by Brenda Bleden's accent, but it is a well-written character drama where you both feel sorry for this person and understand that she both committed crimes and then lied to everyone around her for so long that's kind of, it's an issue. And so it's complicated, and I think they do a pretty good job of dealing with that.
Yeah, they're also dealing with the odd hurdle of, because of the construct of the show, they don't do flashbacks or anything like that. So you're dealing with a case from 34 years earlier, and you're essentially left to have this actress monologize everything.
Yeah.
Because there's no other way to talk about the case unless it's from her perspective and her telling the story, and so it kind of becomes a play almost for a little bit.
It does. It definitely does.
I'm not saying it doesn't work, but that's sort of not what this show does.
And kind of the same way as the last episode we did that was Bound, episode 22, it kind of just grinds to a halt in the second half.
Right.
Where in this case, it's
because we're on a completely different case.
In this case, yeah, it's a totally different case, and again...
And you know that she did it immediately, and so then it's just parsing out how and why, and what is justice?
It becomes a morality play, and I think it's somewhat more successful, but it does kind of slow everything down, and it's not fun, that's for sure.
No, I think it fundamentally, as like a work of TV art or whatever, it fundamentally works better than the last episode Bound did.
Yeah.
The moralizing isn't as engaging necessarily.
Yeah, I would agree.
I had one note. We didn't really talk about it, but back to the first case that we dealt with. Brent is ordered to stay away from Mia and turn in his guns, but he's cut her off, and so she has no one left to turn to for help.
Yeah.
There are a couple things here. There are two instances in this episode where Benson is sort of incredulous towards a victim who offers that they can't get away. They feel like they're trapped in this situation. She's sort of incredulous and doesn't understand how this could be. Seems a little odd because Benson's been doing this for fucking 11 years now, because it's season 10.
Well, given her backstory and the fact that she's been on this job for at least 10 years.
Yeah, and especially as we find out later, there were no women's shelters in New York, and Benson knew this apparently.
Yeah.
There were no women's shelters in New York in 1974, so...
It doesn't read
that well. The incredulity doesn't play here.
Yeah.
So I don't really get that. We also, the Mia character, Clea DuVall's character, came up poor, and now she's on the Upper East Side, and so there's a weird moment, kind of like in the last episode, where we go to, in the last episode it was nursing home, and this episode it's the battered women's shelter. I mean, it doesn't look nice, but it's not a total dump. And the instant she gets into her room or living quarters or whatever the fuck it is, the instant she gets in there, she's like turning up her nose, and you can sense the instant Benson leaves the room, she's going back to that fucking shithead.
Yeah.
So 5 seconds later, she's back with hubby, somnambulating towards her death.
Yeah, and hubby's wearing a very short robe as he answers the door.
Ugh, what a dick bag.
Again, second episode in a row where we have a really gross robe.
Yeah. This one's even grosser because that other guy is kind of awesome.
Yeah, that other guy is somebody we can get behind. Yeah. Like, he's
the elder fucker?
Yeah.
He's awesome.
Yeah.
And then we have the weird, I actually kind of really like this moment for Benson where he answers the door and tries to hold her off and she's like, no, fuck off.
Yeah.
I'm going in there.
Yeah.
I'm legally allowed to make sure that she's okay and to ensure her safety.
Well, and as part of the whole morale morality play, I thought the battered women shelter segment worked well because Benson's forced to confront the fact that in some ways she's doing exactly the same thing that the yes. abusive husband did, which is basically telling this woman all the rules and giving her a very regimented structure to her life and not letting her make her own choices. Now, of course, as it turns out, Clea DuVall makes bad choices, but you know, you understand it from her perspective. And
right. There is a interesting bit basically right after Mia's murdered.
With Craig, between Craig and Liv.
Yes. The weird part of this is that he states that he's never seen Olivia lock up a victim because Olivia believes that if she had just arrested her for filing a false claim, she could have dropped charges later and maybe talked some sense into her.
Yeah.
And he says that he'd never seen Olivia lock up a victim. The detectives did, in fact, once have a rape victim locked up, Jennifer Neal, when she refused to name her rapist.
Mm.
I don't remember what episode that is, but that's a note on the fandom persona page.
I wouldn't be surprised if they lock up victims all the time, honestly. I'm trying to think if any of the ones that we've seen, they've locked up a victim, but
I've definitely seen it happen before.
Yeah.
Not in any of the ones that we've done, but at least I've seen them charge somebody with a crime to get them to flip.
Yeah, exactly. So, you got anything else with the kind of recap analysis?
I think I'm pretty much done with notes. We can get into rating this fucker.
I've got one thing for the New York State of Mind. There's only one address given in this episode. It is for the brownstone where everybody lives. It's 11 East 83rd Street is the address given. Now, it wasn't 11 East 83rd Street at all. And that's because, well, for one thing, if it were 11 East 83rd Street, there's a view down towards the park. And East 83rd Street goes into the Met. So the Metropolitan Museum of Art is in Central Park, and it occupies basically a whole corner of it. And any of the streets that would be going into the Met, you would see a very large, you know, neoclassical building. It's a huge, very famous building.
Yes.
In fact, it's also not on the east side, because you can see, if you look very carefully, that there's two-way traffic on the street in the background between the park and where the apartment is. So it had to have been on the west side, because Central Park West is a two-way street. Fifth Avenue, which is the east side of Central Park, is a one-way street. And the apartment, both of them, the brownstone upstairs and the sub-level apartment, are both gorgeous.
Yeah, they could pass for being Upper East Side.
Yeah, absolutely. They're both beautiful places.
They're just not Upper East Side.
Yeah, they're not. They're across. They're the other side somewhere. Didn't do the effort to figure out exactly which block that was, because there's like 60 of them.
You didn't want to parse every single brownstone from the street to figure out which brownstone it was?
I thought about it, but no, I opted not to. So yeah, okay, that's all I got for that. Let's get to rating this thing. So again, we do a rating every week. You guys probably know this by now if you've been listeners of the show. It's a 1 through 10 scale. We judge on quality, the quality of the guests, how problematic the episode was, and how deeply and how widely people's lives were ruined by the course of events in the episode. And we come up with a composite score, kind of like figure skating at the Olympics. So let's talk about the last one first, the depth and breadth of lives ruined. Because I think in this episode, obviously, Clea DuVall is dead.
Mm-hmm.
From there, though...
That's kind of it, though. Oh, well, Mike Farrell's character.
Mike Farrell's character...
His last 40 years are fucking erased, and he realizes that 34 years. They've been together 34 years.
Yeah.
So 34 years of his life was completely misspent, and this person who he loved has been lying to him.
Yeah. He doesn't have grandchildren.
Yes.
Because of this. Now, at the same time, you feel really bad for Brenda Bleden too, because even though she had been lying to him, they had a very loving, caring relationship where they took care of each other.
Yeah. They were lies to service her self-preservation.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And that's shattered now. And both of them have to start from scratch as elderly people, in one case in a wheelchair.
But I mean, we just watched an episode where all the olds in New York get their fuck on nonstop.
Yeah.
So maybe it's not that bad, but he's probably...
I can see Mike Farrell getting his fuck on. He seems to be a gallivanting man about town once he fires up the old chair and gets out of the apartment.
They mentioned that he's been in a chair for 40 years. It seems odd. They talk about the fact that he wasn't at one point in a wheelchair and then was in his late 20s, early 30s. He ended up wheelchair bound.
Yeah.
But he doesn't look like he's suffering from a condition that might have caused that. So I'm curious as to why he's in a chair.
Well, it was probably a wound suffered during Korea, you know, when he was, you know, some mortars
maybe
fell on
the
surgical tent.
Maybe he actually could be a Vietnam
tent.
Vet.
Yeah.
He's of the age that he could have been a Vietnam vet. So
I'm sure mortars, like rounds.
There's that. But it seems weird that they wouldn't have talked.
Incoming rounds hit the surgical tent or something like that, you know? So it's possible. Yeah. So obviously it's not the wanton destruction that we saw in the last episode.
Last week. There aren't dozens murdered?
No.
And scads more who have their inheritance fucking stolen by a fake charity?
Yeah, no. There's two deaths that are sort of attributed to this episode, and one of them happened 34 years ago. And
that fucker should be
dead.
Yeah,
and then there's one relationship that's sadly broken up. And also, Donnelly's confidence is a victim of this episode.
Well, I actually think Donnelly's better off in the end. She's gotten closure, so if anything, her arc in this episode is actually sort of a...
No, yeah, definitely. Absolutely. She definitely grows because of it. And that's one of the best parts is, like, Donnelly's expression of just, like...
It's weird seeing her play a human for an episode.
Oh, shit, I've been a massive bitch for the last 34 years.
And I guess I shouldn't have been.
But, I mean, what are we talking here? A three?
Three. There's just not that much.
I mean, yeah, sure.
I mean, there is a scope of 34 years of two people's lives that has been erased.
Yeah.
And razed to the ground, but...
Sure, it is burned to the ground, but it's like, they still had a pretty good life even through those 34 years, so it's like, you're gonna have some good memories.
And he's still gonna have his fucking $40 a month rent, so it's cool.
Yeah, exactly. How problematic was this episode? So this is an interesting question, right?
Yeah.
Because it's different than other episodes because it's a morality play.
Yeah. The biggest area where it's problematic is in the first case.
Yeah.
Once we're in the second half of the episode, it's all really trying to move past the specter of a male-dominated society.
Sure.
Wherein women's roles were diminished.
I would say the only thing that's really fun problematic, though, is, you know, butt sex aside, the... opening scene at the pharmacy is the only like fun problematic part where you're like shocked and but also like kind of gleefully shocked. So I don't think it's that problematic.
Oh, wait. Right after that, we have Benson implying that maybe that pharmacist should get raped.
Yeah, that's true. But I'm saying all the fun stuff happens like in the cold open, basically.
Yeah, but that's kind of the case with a lot of episodes. As they're setting the stage, that's when all the fucked up shit happens. And then, you know, especially in Act 4, there's virtually nothing.
And then Benson does disrobe that chick also. So I don't know. But
I mean, it's not heavy on it, but it's... Yeah, five probably.
What it is kind of shocking. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm fine with five.
Benson implies that pharmacist should get raped. That in and of itself is...
Yeah, that's pretty brutal.
She disrobes Clea DeMaul.
She disrobes the chick, yeah.
Two really odd, sort of fucked up things Benson does. And she doesn't understand how someone can't leave. And it's like, not everyone has a financially stable life.
It's true. So let's talk about the guests. Because I think this is both its greatest asset and maybe its greatest problem. The whole episode is the guests. Because Clea DeMaul is great. Mike Farrell's great.
The hubby shithead.
Nathaniel Marston is great. Yeah, and all the you know, regulars. Judith Light, obviously, is Elizabeth Donnelly. She's great.
She really gets to do some actual work here.
Mm-hmm, exactly. O'Halloran's great.
Obviously.
But Brenda Bledin.
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. She has so much in the episode, and when she's doing the work and the accent isn't breaking, it works, but the accent breaks enough that you're sort of left...
I wish they just made her English.
Yeah.
You know, made her a young... Yeah. Like Londoner exchange student who this happened to, you know, after she got married in the States.
I'll never understand why we don't just have the actors do the fucking accent they speak with. You can, especially in episodes where they're from
doesn't matter. Or you can easily just add like three lines at the end after you've already cast it. Just add one line of exposition saying that she came over as an exchange student and stayed because she met this strapping young poet. or whatever.
I mean, I've seen two Teresa Palmer movies lately, and Teresa Palmer, every time she says a number, says it in her Australian accent.
Yeah.
The last one was a shitty movie that How Did This Get Made, did 222, and she could have just been Australian. She's flying into New York when we meet her. She could have been from Australia. She didn't need to be from here. There was nothing tying her to New York, and yet she's a New Yorker in this movie. Just fucking have her be Australian. Have Brenda Bledin be English.
Yeah, Brenda Bledin is so English, it hurts. Just let her be English. And it would have been really good if she had just been English. I mean, really, the biggest problem for me with the whole episode is her accent, because it really kind of takes away from what are pretty powerful scenes of dealing with these issues that are...
It's just like Connie Nielsen.
Yeah.
Just like Connie Nielsen in the episode that we did with Connie Nielsen, where she's doing a weird, I don't know, Danish New Yorker accent, and it just doesn't fucking fly.
She's so Danish, and she does not do an American accent, and it's distracting. So, I don't know. Where did we get
this? New York is a fucking cosmopolitan city. It's maybe the most cosmopolitan city in the fucking world. It doesn't make any sense that she couldn't have a goddamn British accent.
There are plenty of Danish people in New York City right now, as we speak. So, what are we going to call this? A six? Because it's up and it's down?
It can't be higher just because the accent's so
distracting.
But it can't
be much lower because they're all good.
You know, six seems defensible.
So, the last one, of course, overall quality. What do you think about this?
Six-ish.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think that's about right. It's solid, and it's good, and it confronts an issue smartly, but at the same time, it's not fun.
It feels more like an episode of the original series, only without the line of demarcation at the halfway point where it becomes a courtroom drama.
It sure does. Well, that gives us a composite score of 5. So, square in the center, and it works.
That tracks.
Yeah, it's a 5. It's good. It's good, but it's not...
Yeah.
It's not awesome, and it's not fun. Bound
has, I mean,
lots of fun stuff,
man.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's insane. Bound has the boy toy.
Yeah, the boy toy alone.
The boy toy. If the boy toy was in this episode, it would have been.
Okay. I just fired up the randomizer for next week, guys. Because that's the last thing we do every week of Munch My Benson. We see what we're going to watch next. And it gave me one of those ominous numbers that starts with a 3. It's 306.
Fuck.
So let's track this down real quick.
It's season 14.
Okay.
Episode 11. It is called Beautiful Frame. If we look it up, SVU clashes with the Suffolk County DA, who is prosecuting a recent rape victim for her boyfriend's murder, whilst the apparent rapist is suspected of framing the rape victim by the SVU.
Interesting.
So, this one features Jane Kaczmarek as the presumed DA from Suffolk County. Looking at the rest of the guest stars, I'm not really seeing anyone I notice. We're firmly in
Amaro land.
The Barba years. Barba and Amaro.
Yeah.
And it's before Carisi's on the show. So hopefully we're not dealing with too much early Rollins or Amaro backstory in this one.
We'll see. They do a lot of that.
They do.
So I guess until next time, Munch My Benson.
And Munch My Benson.
Are you doing okay?
Yeah, she's resting, but she's pretty shaken up.
Rapist really worked her over.
And so did that pharmacist. You know, too many of them think they have the right to push their beliefs on their patients.
Maybe if they'd been raped, they'd be more compassionate. Mm-hmm.